Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to a special edition of the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum webcast. Today is Wednesday, March 21st, and our guest today is a distinguished alternative energy expert by the name of Andrew Makrowski. Mr. Makrowski is a graduate of the University Politecnico of Milan, Italy, and has worked for the Canadian government in various positions. He has consulted on productions relating to alternative energy, such as a TV special about Nikola Tesla, the forgotten genius. And he has represented alternative energy science before the United Nations, working for the ECOSOC, that is the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. Mr. Makrowski has been acquainted with inventors of water fuel devices such as Dr. Henry or Andrija Puark, Ewell Brown, and others. And he is the president of the Planetary Association for Clean Energy, which, again, is a special consultant for the United Nations. So we are awaiting Mr. Makrowski's call at this time, and we look forward to hearing many interesting things relating to his years of experience. You can log on to the website for the Planetary Association for Clean Energy and order literature and videos relating to this technology. In fact, as far as I know, his organization has been the only source of a lecture by Andrija Puark from the late 1970s in which he explains how his U.S. patent water fuel device functions and why it is so important to implement such technology. Being that he was a medical doctor, he was quite aware of the ramifications of the use of fossil fuel on the planet and on the health of living things. And so he was especially passionate about the introduction of a smarter technology for powering our world. Let's see if we don't have Mr. Makrowski with us at this time. Apparently not. So what I'm going to do while we wait for him to log on is to interview a gentleman who just happens to be here in my studio with me by the name of Willard Elliott. Mr. Elliott is from Manitoba, Winnipeg, Canada, and he has many years of experience as a broadcast engineer. He has started an organization dealing with the construction of electrolyzers to power our world. And perhaps we can get him on the line here, right here in our studio, and ask a few questions of him relating to his experience with this technology. Let's see here now. Willard, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Well, it's nice that at a time such as this, when our guest is not yet called in, we have someone intelligent and knowledgeable to talk to, right here in the studio.
Yeah, I hope I can help out. What would you like to talk about?
Well, first of all, when did you first get interested in alternative energy?
Oh, I guess it was at the time of the Pons and Fleischmann events in Salt Lake City. I actually played with Cold Fusion for a while. I subscribed to the magazine put out by Mr. Green about Cold Fusion, and I studied it, and I put together a cold fusion thing and got over Unity Energy immediately.
So you had success in doing your own cold fusion experiment?
I did.
Very interesting. What about those who poo-poo the idea that cold fusion is possible? What would you say to them?
Well, they've never tried it because it does work, and it works every time.
Now, obviously, you went about it in a different way than Pons and Fleischmann did.
Well, I started out using two nickels, just ordinary money nickels, and put them into a solution with Arm & Hammer washing soda, and it worked like a charm.
Now, obviously, you had to apply some voltage.
I applied a voltage, and I found from experiment the voltage must be above 23 or 24 volts. If it's not above that, you don't get any cold fusion overheating.
So was that a pulsed voltage or?
No, it's not pulsed. It's just straight DC.
So you're saying that if a person, any person, immerses two nickels. Now, were those Canadian nickels or U.S. nickels?
They were Canadian nickels, of course.
Does that make a difference, do you think? Or?
I don't think it makes a difference.
Okay, a nickel's a nickel. Now, you immerse two nickels in a solution of water with just washing powder?
Yes, just
clothes washing powder.
Clothes washing powder that's known as Arm & Hammer.
Is that important that it be that brand? Does that have particular ingredients in it?
It has particular ingredients in it. It is the chemical formula itself.
And can you name the chemical that's in that washing powder?
So long ago I did that I would hesitate to name it in case I've got it wrong.
But I mean the active ingredient in that washing powder that would be important. Do you know what it is?
It is. It is very important, yeah. It's a phosphate or non-phosphate type of washing powder.
Okay. So
for sale here in Lexington.
But you don't know what the ingredient is.
I can't tell you offhand at the moment because it's so long ago, but it was mentioned in the Cold Fusion magazine that this also worked, and I figured, well, I should have that in my chemistry set, and I looked in the chemistry set, and it was there. And then I discovered it's the same thing that Arm & Hammer make for washing soda.
How do you like that? So it's not something like borax or something?
I considered I did my first cold fusion experiment for less than $5 expense.
Amazing. And this is something that university physicists say is impossible, and yet you did it with household...
Well, one of the things that makes many university professors think it's impossible is that you must have at least 6 inches between your electrodes. And if they do it in a small beaker, there's no way they can have 6 inches between the two electrodes. So you have to do it in a large measuring cup or in a cake pan or something of that sort. I used Pyrex.
So you're saying that the major stumbling block to the world benefiting from cold fusion is the size of beaker that they use?
If they use too small a beaker, it won't work.
That's rather absurd, isn't it?
Isn't it? So all those say don't work. They didn't try it in a larger scale.
That's unbelievable.
It is.
Okay, so you take two nickels. You take, what did you say, 24 to 30 volts?
Yeah, 24 or more volts.
Okay, and you simply apply DC current to two nickels in a solution containing an ingredient that's found in common washing powder.
Yeah.
And you get what?
You get about 24% more energy than you would have if you had a resistor heating the water the same amount of wattage going in as you have going into this cold fusion.
And so you refer
to
that as...
So you're about 24% over unity. And if you do it with gold elements in the water, you easily, almost every time, get 200% out.
But no one's been able to afford the gold. They can afford a nickel, but not the gold.
Well, the reason I can afford the gold is I used to build satellite receivers, and they had all gold-plated connectors, and I just used the outer body of these connectors because I had lots of them left in stock, and I put them in the water, and they're best placed right floating on the surface of the water. So you put a little piece of wood to hold the... gold contact, and that piece of wood can be over 6 inches long, so you hold one contact in one end of the wood and the other contact in the other end of the wood, and put a couple of flexible wires from those gold connectors up to a cap on your... I used 1 gallon pickle jars, and as you run it, of course, the water disappears, eventually evaporating out of it. So the flexible wires allow the contacts to remain right at the surface. As if they're below the surface or above the surface, well, naturally above the surface doesn't work. If they're below the surface, you don't get quite the overunity as you do when they're right on the surface.
Very interesting. So this took place then in the 1980s? This first experiment you did?
Yeah, the first experiment was about around 1990, because I had heard of it in 1989 when they first did it. And then I, one of my trips to Florida, I heard about the magazine, and I went to New York. No, it wasn't New York. I went to Toronto and asked if this magazine was available, and they sent me to a special bookstore. And they said, if anybody have it, that bookstore will have it. Sure enough, they had one copy, so I picked up the magazine, Cold Fusion, and then I subscribed to it.
So the title of the magazine was Cold Fusion.
It was published by Wayne Green, the same guy that published the radio amateur magazine.
And you, being a ham radio enthusiast, you were...
For quite a few years, yeah.
Yeah, well acquainted with that. So this had nothing to do with the late... the gentleman who published Infinite Energy magazine.
Well, some of his stuff was written up in Wayne Green's Cold Fusion magazine.
I'm referring to the MIT scientist.
Yeah, yeah, I know who you're speaking about, yeah.
For some reason, I can't think of his name at this
moment. Malinoff?
Malinoff, yes, Eugene Malinoff. Thank you.
Yeah, Eugene, yeah.
Okay, so prior to getting interested in cold fusion, you had never... paid much attention to the work of Tesla or other...
Well, I knew about Tesla, of course, and he is responsible for all our alternating current that allows us to transport power all over the nation.
Had you heard of his work with free energy devices?
I had not heard of his work with free energy devices at the time, but I did go to... a place in Colorado where there was a museum about Tesla.
Yeah, that would be in Colorado Springs, I believe.
Colorado Springs, you're right.
Went to that museum while it was open.
I went to that museum while it was open, and I saw many of the things that Tesla had been working on. They had a model of his magnifying transmitter tower right there.
So you may have met J.W. McGinnis at that time.
I did meet J.W., yeah.
Okay, J.W. actually came... to Kentucky a few months back. Yeah, got to meet him and took him to meet an inventor near Lexington, where we are now.
Oh, very good.
In fact, it was Elihu, who you know. You
oh, yeah,
me,
I remember Elihu, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see now. So 1990, thereabouts, you got interested in cold fusion. And
that's right.
You actually went to the Tesla Museum in Colorado Springs at one time.
Yeah.
How did you get switched over from cold fusion to water fuel technology?
Well, I heard of a fellow called Troy Reed, and Troy Reed had a that I heard a beep there. Was that anything important?
No, it's nothing important.
Nothing. He had a generator that once you started it up, it would run all by itself and generate. So I thought rather than fool around with all the chemicals of cold fusion, it'd be better to just do it electrically with these self-running generators. But in pursuing that, I found that not any of them that I could build would ever work. They were all less than 30% or 33% efficient. And there's a guy in New Zealand. His name is Robert Adams. He had a motor that he claimed was over unity, but I built a very elaborate version of it. And it's definitely not over unity.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your other phone ringing? Or
no, that's fine.
Nothing
we're
important.
Fine.
So I progressed from trying to build motors that would do this into the Stanley Meyer thing. And I thought, well, I can easily make that, make it work. So around 1998, I got building a electrolyzer cell and experimenting, trying to find the elusive resonant frequency, and I found there was none. And I had no success in creating any more than Faraday electrolysis.
Okay, and yet you didn't get discouraged.
I'm not discouraged. I'm still hoping to run my 1978 Ford station wagon on water.
Although in view of recent developments, it may not be necessary to use such an old vehicle.
No, I guess I could even convert my new fuel-injected Buick, which is all computer-controlled.
Yeah, according to Paul Zagouras, who has recently been quite newsworthy along the lines of water fuel technology, you're actually better off using a newer vehicle that has tighter valves to avoid backfire. He claims that the newer the engine, the better, because of the condition of the valves.
Yeah, the valves have to be good. I know, I realize that.
Mm-hmm. Whereas we had previously thought that an older vehicle is better because you're avoiding the computer and the fuel injection and so on.
Simpler carburetor, yeah.
And yet Paul says that that doesn't matter because when you are using water fuel, you just bypass the fuel injection system by removing the fuse from the injector system, and allow the car's computer to regulate itself, or regulate the engine, the spark timing,
the timing,
based on the new fuel, which apparently is more of a problem when you're adding hydrogen and oxygen as a boost than when you're using it as the sole fuel.
Yeah, when you use it as sole fuel, you want to have the timing either at top dead center or slightly after.
Okay. I think our guest may be calling in right now, Willard.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk to you further on another occasion.
Okay. We'll say bye for now.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Let's see if we don't have Mr. Mikrowski with us.
Yes, I'm on the line now.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for joining us.
Yes.
We've used the past 15 minutes talking to a Canadian, another Canadian, who just happened to be in my home on a visit as he's passing through heading to Florida.
I see.
And that's Willard Elliott, who's from Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been a water fuel enthusiast for quite a few years.
Oh, really?
He has quite a background in broadcast engineering, so he's pretty familiar with electronic circuitry. And he has been here. Actually, he came a year ago on a similar trip to Florida. He stopped in Kentucky and visited the museum and actually ended up staying about a week.
Wow.
And we did some efforts at replication of some different systems.
Okay.
So we're enjoying that kind of...
Okay. I'm sorry about getting this late. Okay.
No, that's no problem at all. First of all, I'd like to have you say a few things about your background. I've already mentioned some of the things that you've been involved in, but I'd like to ask you just more on a personal level. When did you become interested in alternative energy technology?
Oh, I became interested when I was asked by the federal government to look into the long-term energy prospects for Canada as chief planner of Northern Development. That meant anything from the Arctic gas pipelines and oil gas pipelines. There's also the Hydro-Quebec dams in Quebec and in northern Manitoba. So I was involved in these to see whether the Canadian government should or should not invest the billions of dollars that, in the meantime, they have for these projects to bring power to the United States. Yeah.
And how long ago was that?
This would have been around 1972-73.
Okay, very good. So right around the time...
And then I realized because I had the freedom to move around, this was a very high-level position, that in the north, things do not have a renewal process as in the south. Like, for example, it can take trees 50 or 60 years to mature when in the south it only takes 5, 10, 15. So and if you do disrupt, say, the life cycle of a fish group, well, you're doing on a very severe way. So I realized very quickly that mega projects such as the Canadian government was considering would have not only impact on Canada, but probably on about anywhere from a third to two-thirds of the planet, because whatever happens in the north eventually has an effect below. For example, if plankton start disappearing, I'm just giving an example, and most of the plankton is in the north, then it has an effect on the food chains for lots of other things, and eventually even you can't fish in Florida, as much as you could in the past. So this is, whatever you do has to be thought through, and you have to assure that there are alternatives. And, of course, this is where I discovered Nikola Tesla, and a few other things, including eventually water as a fuel. Yeah.
Now, were you always aware of Tesla's work and the possibility of using water as fuel, or when did you become?
Well, Tesla, I became very aware very quickly. I happened to have found in the National Library of Canada the last book available in any library in North America that they disappeared, so to speak. I had to bring it from Victoria, British Columbia, from the only library that had one, which was by O'Neill. This was the science editor of the New York Herald Tribune, who, by the way, was the man who was the only writer at that time capable of explaining Einstein to the American population. And he was a great friend of Nikola Tesla and wrote a wonderful book called Prodigal Genius. And that book gave me enough information, including to search for files and so on, of patents and whatnot.
Now, do you mean to tell me that this book, written about Tesla back in the early part of the 20th century...
Yeah, this was written in the 1950s.
Oh, 1950s.
Is yeah, and I
only
I
one copy was available?
Well, now it is available everywhere. It's a book that I made reprinted and found some philanthropists who reprinted that book.
You were responsible for that?
Yes, and then of course, a number of other books got reprinted, too. There was another book written by two ladies in Denver area, Lightning in His Hand, who described Tesla's work in Colorado Rockies, and I had that reprinted too.
But you feel that the initial volume that you were describing, that it disappeared from library shelves?
Yeah, there was no book nowhere. Even the Library of Congress didn't have a copy anymore.
Interesting.
So it was a real feat to do this. As a matter of fact, another very shocking story is Westinghouse Electrical Company wrote a book, which they flaunted in 1904, thanking Nikola Tesla for, you know, actually making Westinghouse what it became, because Westinghouse before was an air brake company, you know, for locomotives, you know.
Yes.
And it became, because an electrical company, thanks to the fact that Tesla worked with George Westinghouse. Anyway, in this book that they produced, there was a lecture that Tesla gave to the IEEE, IEEE, there was an Institute for Electrical Engineers, Philadelphia, plus a version of a wireless transmission showing what he had done in Colorado. On this book, believe it or not, when the several years later in the 80s, the head of Westinghouse was asked, did you know that you guys... supported Tesla, and so, oh, come on, that's impossible, I don't know. Well, it turned out that even when they look in their archives, they didn't even have a copy of that book anymore. And fortunately, there was still one copy in the Nikola Tesla Museum in Yugoslavia, which was brought over to show to the Westinghouse people that it did exist. And of course, you know, there was no thanking Tesla thousands of times for what they made that company so huge. I also found out that Westinghouse was kicked away by the board of directors of Westinghouse Company and ended up his last years of his life were as a beachcomber.
You
because
mean
the shareholders
himself?
Didn't want him to have any money.
Interesting.
So America was what it was, even... before World War II, a very difficult environment for creative people. You know.
Well, it has to do with the income streams of the very wealthy, who basically.
Well, we're not necessarily wealthy. The people who were shareholders in Westinghouse were not wealthy people. They were just unscrupulous people.
Yes.
So.
Well, people trying to protect their wealth.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't take a person to be super rich.
No. Because the people who helped Tesla were very rich. The people who really like Astor family and the J.P. Morgan and a number of very, very wealthy people had the largesse and the the openness of mind to see here's a real genius who could help them in the meantime. But they treated Tesla, generally speaking, very humanely. You know, I mean, there were exceptions when the recessions would come around and so on. You know.
Well, the day came when the plug was pulled, as they say, on Tesla by Morgan, when the issue of free energy.
Well, it may have not been free energy. It may have been the fact that Tesla was saying you could do all this without the copper wires. And lots of investments were made to make wires.
So it had more to do with the wires than with the metering.
That's right. Well, the meters, no. Tesla's system would have always allowed meters. This is how our association grew. As a matter of fact, when I knew more about Tesla, and of course there were more people who knew that I knew about Tesla, I was approached by IBM directors and chief scientists, and they told me that IBM was not able to patent the entire PC. Because of a Tesla patent, a claim and proof of a claim too, that Tesla had a system whereby when he would send electricity wirelessly, he would still know who got the electricity. Like even if you were to send right now, say to an office in Kabul, Afghanistan, electricity from New York City today, you would know, according to the Tesla system of the binary code, that Mr. So-and-so in Kabul received electricity and so many watts or whatever, because there would be a feedback system that would tell that. But it required a computing and also a remote control system that nobody could interfere with.
Well, that would be basically like cell phone service then, wouldn't it?
It would be like what, excuse me?
Like cellular phone service.
In a way, yeah, that's right. That test already developed that in 1899. So because of that, IBM could not use binary code because the whole system of secret, information and also remote, gathering of information and receipt was already taken care of by a Tesla system. And, of course, the only reason why we have a competitive computer market, like you have Macintoshes and so on, is thanks to Tesla, because he did that patent in 1899, which allowed for wireless controls, wireless information gathering, from remote places and so on. And coding as well.
Very interesting. Now, so you became quite an expert in the history of Tesla's work.
Yeah, eventually, yes, because I got to know some people who were still alive. This was in the 70s, who knew Tesla. Some of them were FBI agents who had been assigned by Roosevelt to protect Nikola Tesla. Some were
a national security issue of what he knew?
No. What was important at that time was that Nikola Tesla, this is World War II now, both Stalin and Hitler had made overtures to Nikola Tesla to help them in their projects, and Tesla refused. So there was a true fear that something could happen to him in terms of America losing strategic information.
Yes, like if he were kidnapped or something.
Well, kidnapped or extorted and so on.
Yeah.
This was a presidential order, I suppose, to do that. And the people who were assigned to protect Nikola Tesla were very well-trained people. One of them was an MIT engineer, even though he was an FBI agent. I learned a lot about Tesla that way. Plus,
in other words, you were able to interview him, and he understood the science of what Tesla was talking about.
Yeah, and there were lots of things, I shouldn't say lots, there were some things that Tesla never published, which became very important today. One of them is, by the way, the system of multiplying amplifying energy, Basically, one of the main tenets of amplifying is that if you have X number of watts per second, well, if you can concentrate that into milliseconds, then you have much more power per, because it's all concentrated in the millisecond, several milliseconds instead of over a whole, whole second. So this was a very, very important aspect of Tesla's work, which has never been published anywhere, but which became true. One of our colleagues, the method by which we have hearing aids and bugging systems may become much more sensitive, if you wish.
Yeah, well, I'm very happy to hear that electronic surveillance has improved. What about the claim that Tesla had a vehicle running on a...
Oh, that is quite definitive. As a matter of fact, some of our colleagues were able actually to interview one of the people who actually went in that car, who was a Yugoslav boxer that Tesla admired. And like there was two boxers who came from, I think they were brothers, who came from the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. This is where we were before World War II. And Tesla was so proud to have them, he drove them from New York City to Buffalo in his car. After a while, they say, aren't you ever going to stop in a gas station? And then, of course, Tesla was, very proudly showed them what's there. And all they saw, besides the normal engine, et cetera, was a little antenna inside the hood.
Now, are you saying that this car did not use an electric motor or did?
I do not know what kind of motor but it was the energy to drive it was actually in the form of it must have been an electrical motor. You're right, because then all it did was he was able to render random background radiation into a 60 cycle system.
So he was basically...
He was reconstituting every, 60 times a second a sine wave.
Hmm.
Good power.
Very interesting. So is there any other documentation of this? Are there any pictures existing of this configuration?
No, not really. It's just that what was felt very important, or at least for the investigator that went into this, was to interview at least one of the people who saw it, Because that's something he gains. Tesla never talked about this.
Very interesting. And this is what's known as his Pierce Arrow, is that correct?
I'm sorry, say that again?
His vehicle, this was a Pierce Arrow?
Yeah, that's right, the Pierce Arrow, that's right.
Okay. But there's never been any documentation of what happened to it or anything?
Well, there's
like that.
No. We have published a book, I'm sorry, a little article, which is in a little booklet, about this, the analysis makes very good sense. It was written by a man called Oliver Nicholson, whose training, by the way, was novel. He was one of the first to do this, was to look at the history of science, but in the perspective of what was known at the time that an invention was made. Not the way we see it today, but you have to always put yourself... What was it like, say, in 1930? What was it like in 1920? What was available in those days? What were things called in those days? Because sometimes the wording that was used, even by Tesla, it doesn't mean the same thing that we use it today.
Sure.
So you have to always think, when Tesla wrote this, this word meant, whatever, so one has to be very careful about that,
Yeah. Now, let's take just a second, and since you mentioned a booklet that you have available, why don't we tell the listening audience what it is that your organization does as far as making materials available. You do have...
Okay. Well, first of all, we were created by the senator who was responsible for the science policy of Canada at that time, which is still in place, and he was also head of the science, Health and Science Committee. In the Senate. He had this idea that there should be something that scans future scientific and technological issues for the nation. And one of the problems in Canada, it still is a problem, there are still some provinces, because, like Newfoundland, that are energy poor or totally dependent on foreign sources, electric, you know. So he wanted to make sure that somehow that could be shared. We're just too large a country to be able still, and too small a population to be able to take care of every part of our country properly. And so the issues that that solutions that Tesla afforded were very important. So that led to a whole discussion of things to do, things to check out and verify and so on. And because the federal government was afraid of bad relationship between provinces and federal government on, say, new developments in science and technology, it's very hard to get all provinces to agree to everything that everyone else does. So the senator said, "The hell with it, let's do it as citizens." And instead of thinking about Canada alone, we'll think about the entire world. And that's how our association was founded. So we were a network of lots of people. By this time, by that time, about 50, 100 scientists worldwide, who were at least focused on Tesla and a few other things of this nature. We created this Planetary Association of Clean Energy, which eventually became a learner society in Canada. That is, it became as if you, if we were in the United States, we became part of the National Academy of Sciences and all. So we had, in that sense. But the only interdisciplinary body that existed of that nature in Canada. And then we went out to outreach to the United Nations. We're now part special consultative status with the United Nations. But what we have done was, through our growing network, which now is several thousand people, have looked at things and peer-reviewed that normally are ignored by the rest of the scientific community. Some of these things are related to energy, as we're talking about, you know, electrical energy. Some are related to the environment. Some are related to health. And so on. Now, in the energy picture, what we've been able to define over all these years since the 1970s is a number of technologies that are very promising, very important, truly clean. And by the way, we're the ones who first started the word clean energy, and also everyone using that term.
Really?
But in those days, when we created our name, we actually had a journalist from a major TV station company in Canada, who said, "What do you mean by clean energy? Do you have Javix or what?" You know, it was such an unknown quantity. You know, the notion was that clean energy had to be universal. It has to be something that you can have anywhere, you know, in the world at least. It has to be universally applicable. It can't only be applied in one part of the world, two parts, or whatever. It has to be self-replenishing. It has to have no residue, and it has to be inexpensive. It has to be something that even a guy who only earns $100 a year can afford, you know, which is what's the case for a very large part of Africa, for example, and certain parts of Asia. The national per capita income is sometimes less than $100 a year. So you have to be able to take care of all those things. And one of those happens to be brown gas. Water is a fuel. So this is...
In other words, something that meets all those requirements.
That's right. That's right. Because there are lots of things that are clean in a way. I mean, they're not polluting, whatever. But they're very, very expensive. Like, you know,
solar energy or something.
Well, even now we have a situation where solar energy could become cheap. There's a technique developed by one of our members. We were the first to publish about it, which imitates chlorophyll. And this was developed by Dr. Alvin Marks, who developed, by the way, Polaroid as a concept, the Polaroid filters and eventually Polaroid cameras. But this allows electricity to be almost 100% efficient, the panels, and they're very cheap to make because they all they require is something as thick as a leaf, even less. Just one layer, or a maximum two layers, of chlorophyll atoms. So it's very, very little material, and you just have to package it, and that's it. You got electricity per square foot.
And how long has this technology been known?
Beg your pardon?
How long has this technology been known?
It's been known since the last 25 years. And
it
would cost less than it costs power to have electrical power today. But nobody wanted to touch it. You know, what can I say? Even the United States government has done a lot of replication studies. Argonne National Laboratory has been involved. Texas A&M and M University have been involved. Have proven this is the best solar technology that exists, you know, but still, it has not come to the forefront.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? Well, let's get back to Brown's Gas.
Yes.
Brown's Gas gets its name from Yul Brown, who was a Bulgarian immigrant to Australia.
That's right.
His original name was different, but he took the name Yul Brown. More English-sounding name.
Well, the way the name Yul Brown came along is very interesting. Yul Brown was a refugee from Bulgaria who ended up for crazy reason in a Turkish jail, and you know how famous Turkish jails are. He was a person who was exemplary in the prison because he was very, creative and so on, was noted by visiting American consul in Istanbul and his wife, by the way, too, as being so helpful to other prisoners. You know, like he would heal them, do whatever he could with what little was available. And
because
so
he was a scientist.
Oh, he was already a scientist. He already discovered his technology. You know, like
he had been a scientist in Bulgaria.
Yes, and he had to escape because he got involved with a commissar's wife.
Ah.
And then the commissar found out about it. So he really had to run for his life, you know. Anyway, so and then he ended up being in a monastery in Bulgaria. And there he looked for the first time in his life. By the way, you're not even allowed to do these things. He looked at the Bible, and it says the world can burn. And said, how can the world burn if it's 70% water? You know?
Yes, I've read about this.
and also, he already remembered vaguely Jules Verne writing about water.
Becoming the fuel of the future.
That's right. So
yes.
He said, you know, there must be something to this, you know. There must be. How can you make fire out of water, you know? So,
mm-hmm.
So
he wasn't able to pursue it in Europe. It was only after he immigrated to Australia that he began researching this.
He already had the electronics in mind. Like, he was an electronic engineer, basically.
Uh-huh.
And so he finally figured out what it was, is that once you disassociate whatever way you do through electrolysis, that you can do it. Now, there was something that he had heard, like that, he's not the guy who discovered that, but that you can still have a gas that has equal proportion of water, hydrogen and oxygen as in water, and it would not explode. Okay, this was something that was known. But nobody tried to put in a chamber and do that. I mean, literally, that you have an enclosed chamber, you let it bubble, and just let the bubbles stay together. Everyone's too scared to try that, you know. Because nobody would
to duct the two gases together. Everyone thought that having hydrogen and oxygen ducted together made it.
That's not, you're not bomb or whatever, you know. But anyway, so this was, he did that and it worked, no problem. Because you, in the old days, I mean, a few people like in Arizona, Rhodes did that too. You would have an oxygen tube, and hydrogen tube, you know, and the right proportions, and you would have eventually a flame, you know, if you do it right. But and a very interesting one too. But that gas, that when you do the two together, it's not the same thing. It's not do the same thing as when you have it done in one container. because what occurs as you bubble your way through and you have this mixture, you do not only have oxygen and molecules and hydrogen molecules. You have a mixture of lots of things. You have hydroxys, you know, OH. You also have the three types of, even in very minute proportions, but three types of hydrogen ions, and you have all the other oxygen ions too, and they come in different combinations. Some have only a lifespan of a millisecond, some have lifespans of a few minutes or whatever, so you have a soup. And
that's
some
a good word. I like that.
Yeah, well, it is. It's a mixture that is not always totally predictable. As a matter of fact, if you actually look at different generators, the slightest flaw they have, you know, if one anode is 1 degree off, not parallel to another, you have a slightly different brown gas. You know,
isn't that interesting?
That's right. In a sense, it will have less power, more power than you know, the previous other machine. So all these things have a factor. And this gas has, because of its nature, has a very unique property, which is that its flame in air, for example, have a certain temperature, depending on the air that we have. Remember, air has different components to it, like nitrogen, oxygen, and so on.
Sure.
And of course, it will have a rather low temperature. It's, if I remember correctly, it's about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. But it will, in front of a barrier, like say a piece of tungsten, it will try to seek the melting point of that material if it's pure. So it will all seek the not the melting point, the boiling point, which is higher. So you can go and say, have a flame touch your skin, and that will be around 106 degrees Celsius, hot enough to tell you to be careful, but not to hurt you if you don't keep it too long. At a certain next second, could be touching tungsten, you could have 6,000 degrees centigrade, you know, which is a very, very high temperature.
Amazing.
So, you cannot do that with the mixture of hydrogen and oxygen molecules. You will not achieve boiling point. As a matter of fact, people have tried that. They will notice immediately that when you do that with tungsten, if you do it with the mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, you have tungsten oxide. But if you do it with brown gas, you just have tungsten, period, and it's boiling. And of course, because of that, you have a different. You don't have the gas. You don't have a yellowish gas coming out of into the air. You know, which is tungsten oxide. So that's the kind of thing that occurs with this gas, which makes it very, very unique, very, very high energetics. It properly, if you know how to handle it. You know.
Now you met Mr. Brown, didn't you?
Oh, many times, yeah. And our association helped him since the 70s. Within weeks that he had made his work, our members had been helping them. And the chief member to help him was Professor John O'Malley Bockwis, who at that time was Dean of Chemistry at Flinders University in Australia.
Well, he's quite famous as an electrochemist, isn't he?
Yes, he's known as the father of electrochemistry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. Mr. Brown did or did not have vehicles running on his gas?
Yes, he did have a car, a typical four-wheel drive car in Australia in the 70s was a Holden. And he was able to drive his car with 1 gallon of water, 1,000 miles.
In other words, he had an onboard hydrogen generator?
Yeah. Well, not hydrogen. It was a brown gas.
Brown gas. But in other words, he was generating the
current. Yeah, you have a battery, a small load generator, because it doesn't take very much gas to do that. You need Actually, all you need is, as a reserve of gas at any particular moment is what you can find in a typical Pepsi-Cola bottle, that the plastic ones for 1.5 liters or whatever they are in ounces, United States. So probably what that you can buy at any supermarket or gas station. So that's all you need is bronze gas to be able to run a car at any particular moment at least 60 miles an hour down the highway.
The volume of gas that's contained in one.
Yeah,
bottle.
That's not even compressed. That's how much you need in reserve.
Isn't that interesting?
And of course, to do that, a 12-volt battery is good enough. If you want, you can also have more.
So I think it has to do more with what you said earlier, and that is that not all the gases that are produced by electrolysis are the same. And if you create a gas that has a higher energy value, which apparently he did.
Well, it would have. You see, let's put it this way. Normal gasoline, unleaded, has, if I remember correctly, something like 47,000 BTUs per pound. Hydrogen is around 50,000. Well, bronze gas starts at 62,000. That's the worst case scenario. But there have been bronze gases created, by very good machines, very high tolerances, that can go up to 200,000 BTUs per pound. And that's at 200. Well, of course, we're not talking. That's not what Eurobrown did for his car. But at 200,000 BTUs, you're now getting to the energy density of nuclear materials, and that's just ordinary water. I mean, no alpha, beta, gamma radiation, nothing. But you still have lots of energetics.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
And that has something to do with the ion bonds, in the water molecule.
You mean the power behind the gas?
Yes, part of it, yeah.
Yeah, because
in the soup, yeah.
Yeah, it appears that different experimenters, different water fuel device developers over the years have been producing different gases because their approach has been different.
Yes, and every approach is very critical. Like I've helped a few people make brown gas generators on the basis of what I've learned. I was really amazed to observe how different designs and, what happens to the gases. Does it create bubbles and doesn't create bubbles, or how do you take care of the foam or when there's foam? All these things have an impact on the type of gas that you can have. Some generators become very hot. Others, I've seen generators that work for 24 hours a day for weeks and they're still cool, and they all produce balanced gas. And so lots of this is ingenuity, and I've been told by people who knew Eurobrown, for years, that sometimes you spend days without sleep watching his generators. He would put them in plexiglass containers or glass containers, just watching all the dynamics that occurred in the generators to see what he could do to improve them.
He really was an excellent scientist, wasn't he?
Yes, and he kept very good records. This is another thing that people do not know. He was a very good record keeper.
Yeah, I have a great deal of respect for Mr. Brown, even though I object to calling the gases Brown's gas.
There's a reason for that. It wasn't the pomposity. Before, it was just, they had no name. People could call it water gas. A good name was hydroxy. he had made an agreement after having the factory and thanks to our members, his reputation was survive in Australia. He was able to have shareholders, create a company, produce generators and so on. Eventually, because also the government of no government in Australia wanted him to have a factory anywhere in Australia, they thought it would be like a huge danger for any place that would have one. So it was very important to get local authorities to accept that this was not a dangerous thing, that was not going to create any explosions or major disaster. And so that's where our members were very critical in getting that first factory built. Now, once he did that, he eventually had started giving licensing. And one of the first licenses was given to a New Zealand party who, unfortunately, were not very correct in their agreement, which I saw, by the way, and made an arrangement with a British bank to get financing to make it on their own, you know, like as if there was their own invention.
To make Brown's gas generators.
Yes, and to make a big business out of it, you know, not just like the $3 million that your Brown got, but maybe like put an investment of 15 or 20 million or to make it really a big worldwide deal. And Yul Brown heard about it, and what little capital he had left, he had to defend himself, which he did successfully, but that depleted all his capital reserves of his company, and he went bankrupt. Now, when he won his case, he had this idea that I have to have some intellectual property protection. And one way of protecting himself was to give this gas a name. And that's how it became Brown's Gas. He said, you know, I'll give it my own name, you know, people. And it's true, you know, because it is called Brown's Gas, even you and I, you know, implicitly understand it to be a certain thing, you know, like because... It has a trademark, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, some other people have recently come up with names like Aquagen and so on. And
yeah.
I don't know. I just don't like the idea of any human putting a trademark.
No, I know, but he didn't like it either. But he said this is the only way I can do this because he also what it also did was that patents only have a certain lifespan, especially in those days. I think it was 17 years. Now could they even have less? You know, you also have to renew it very often. But this way, the gas has become something that even long since the patents have expired, people can still attach themselves to a certain kind of technology and know what they're describing.
Oh, yeah.
And even though maybe there are now about five or six contenders with different names, you know, like water, gas, and whatnot, are facing the fact that there is something that has a very specific characteristic, and it happens to be Brown's gas. So actually, in a way, Yul Brown was right to do this. I mean, this is the way our intellectual property is sort of identified.
Sure, and you know something, he made a great deal of sacrifice during his lifetime to promote the use of this gas, so he
did. Oh, yes, he did a lot, and some of our members, too. We have to know one thing about Brown's Gas, which is fairly little known. When he went bankrupt, he was approached by another one of our members. This time it was a man called Christopher Bird.
You know what? I hate to interrupt you, but you know that we're almost at the end of our hour?
Yes, okay.
And so what I'd like to do is this. We haven't even scratched the surface of the things that we could talk about. I know you have a great deal of information to
yes.
share about many other inventors, especially I would like to have heard today about Andrija Puharic.
Oh, yeah, Andrija Puharic, yes. That's another type of invention, yes.
Yeah, and
it is still Brown's Gas.
Mm-hmm. But I'd like to invite you to join me again as soon as possible to pick up this story where we left off, finishing up with Yul Brown and then...
And then talking about Christopher Bird, which is a very interesting story. Okay.
Oh, or plenty of the others. You know,
yes.
You know more than most people realize, and it would be good for you to share this information with
us. Right, we're great pleasure.
So, what I'd like to do in the final few seconds here is to ask you to tell us what's available on your website.
We have some information about use of Brown's gas for nuclear waste decontamination. It's been done successfully. That was an accidental discovery of Yul Brown. So that's one thing.
You have printed material and videos?
No, this is just printed material.
Okay.
Now, about videos, well, there's a list of what we offer, you know, that there are lots of videos on Yul Brown, including transportation of gold or refining of gold.
And what's the website people need to go to get this?
It's PACENET, that's PACENET, dot homestead.com.
Okay, pacenet.homestead.com.
That's right.
And there they can acquire a vast array of literature that tells the history of these technologies. And
that's right.
Okay, well, listen, our time is up, but I want to thank you for joining us, and I want to be able to announce that in the near future we'll have another interview with you and pick up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks for joining us, and have a good evening.